Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. I'm Adam Bolton. Worldview is the podcast where we speak to leading scholars and experts to unpick the big themes shaping global affairs. In this six-part series, we'll go on to cover energy, leadership, space and technology, all reflecting on war. The first episode, though, for obvious reasons, is shaped directly by the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. On the 24th of February this year, President Putin ordered Russian troops to attack Ukraine, a sovereign independent state, on the supposed pretext of denazification. He had form on this, having annexed Crimea and in 2014 sending in troops to bolster pro-Russian enclaves in the east of the country. That he had largely got away with. This time was different. Ukraine put up concerted resistance, and the West united behind it, providing support short of joining in the war directly. In this first episode, The World Remade, we'll explore where this leaves the global order, established three quarters of a century ago in the wake of the Second World War. Later, I'll be joined by Professor Frank Gavin of Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. First, I spoke to Pauline Neville-Jones, a member of Britain's House of Lords, former security minister, diplomat and chair of the UK's Joint Intelligence Committee, and Professor Beatrice Huser, chair of international relations at the University of Glasgow. I began by asking Professor Huser how much we're all going to have to rethink our ideas.
Massively, because in fact, since the Helsinki Memorandum, the agreement that eventually set up the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, that came out of the long negotiations of the 1970s that ended with the Helsinki Final Act, we had thought that even Russia, the Soviet Union at the time, was playing according to some international rules, which were do not change borders by force. And this is now the first time that Russia, even since 1975, has done something like that. And therefore, we realise that they are introducing new rules to the game. And that means we have a game changer here.
What do you think, Pauline?
Not only have they broken one of the sort of founding principles of New Europe post-Soviet Union, but of course, they've used force in a major way. I mean, this is, I think, different from Georgia or even other activities inside.
I mean, it seems to me that the point is those were all civil wars of a kind, even former Yugoslavia, whereas this is one sovereign nation invading another.
Exactly that. And massively also. It's the size, I think, is also an issue. I mean, this is a major military operation. And it's of a nature, I think, that unlike some of the earlier interventions, the world cannot simply ignore or go back to the status quo ante. First of all, if it's war, you need to win it. That's a game changer in its own right, and that certainly hangs in the balance. And then secondly, what do you do when you do have some kind of outcome? My fear is that we're not going to have an outcome for a very long time, that we're going to be in a state of suspended or not so suspended conflict, but no resolution, no settlement, and indeed no prospect of settlement. So I think we're going into a period of considerable difficulty for Europeans.
Is this really, Beatrice, breaking the rules, the post-war rules that were set after the Second World War, and in a sense going back to the Nazis?
Absolutely. When we had Iraq invade Kuwait, that was such another breach of those rules. But then we simply immediately went on and punished them in a way. We rolled it back. We made sure that this wouldn't go unpunished. Whereas in this case, we have exactly the same thing happening on a somewhat larger scale between a great power, a member of the Security Council, which can therefore paralyze the Security Council, but it has nuclear weapons. And that's the other thing that has not happened to us before since 1945.
And Baroness Neville-Jones, is there anything in the Russian claim that, Ukraine is ours, it's part of greater Russia?
Well, you can go back in history. It's certainly the case that historically Western Ukraine has often been part of Polish-Lithuania polity, and Eastern Ukraine has from time to time owed allegiance to the Tsar. It was certainly an administrative area of the Soviet Union. But it has, in fact, a separate identity. And since the breakup of the Soviet Union, it has developed that identity. And what is very clear from the Russian mistaken notion that here are our fellow Slavs whom we're going to liberate, on the contrary, it's deeply unpopular. And those Russian speakers in Ukraine have on the whole been converted to the majority view. So they've lost out in terms of their own propaganda.
And as I understand it, until the invasion, Russia was actually signed up to that post-Soviet settlement, weren't they?
Absolutely, very importantly. Incidentally, I had a lovely exchange with a Russian colleague teaching at a Russian university in Russia. I said to him, well, how do you feel about now Poland and Austria coming along and saying they want to have parts of Ukraine because they used to own it? And, you know, don't we think that actually Austria has been very gracious in its descent from power? And this Russian colleague answered, I greatly admire Austria. So there are people, at least in the elite in Russia, who really disagree with what Putin is doing.
And Baroness Neville-Jones, I mean, you said if you fight a war, you've got to win it. And I think everyone would agree with that. Did seem to me, and I was at that NATO summit, for example, in Bucharest in 2008, that we did kind of turn our backs. We said, well, Ukraine's not going to join the EU. It's not going to join NATO. Said the same about Georgia. Russians went into Georgia. We didn't do much about that. So there was a kind of an invitation.
Well, I think two things. I mean, one, that we were swithered about on the subject of they shall be, but actually, well, it's a bit inconvenient, too difficult. And so, I mean, it hasn't happened. And that's damaging all round, I think. As for an invitation, no, there's no invitation. But I think the Russians did believe that our reaction would be fairly mild. I don't think they thought that the economic sanctions which have been imposed would be of either the extent or the depth that has been the case, and there's still probably more to come. And what Russia risks, I think, apart from longer-term economic damage, and I don't suggest that this is going to change the course of the war in the short term, but it does risk, I think, a greater impoverishment and also isolation.
There is one line which says, well, NATO was turned its back, wasn't friendly to the Russians after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that therefore, you know, the Russians feel spurned, and that's some sort of justification. Again, do you think there's anything in that?
Really not. No, I think we did so much. We did so much to reach out to Russia. We had all sorts of, for example, the King's College London, as we happened to be here, we had a program that was sponsored by the Volkswagen Foundation that brought over scholars from all of Eastern Europe, including Russia, to study with us. And we reached out in so many ways. We had partnership programs with Russian universities. We tried to bring Russian students over as much as possible. We went to Russia, you know, we did so much. We had joint conferences that we financed every single time. We had archival projects to get archives photocopied from the Russian archives and open them to scholars. Lots.
Okay, so Putin does, though, have a sense of grievance, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Well, it appears so. But he's fabricated a history, actually, to justify what he's doing, which is an unprovoked attack. First of all, these people are Nazis. They shouldn't be in control in Kiev. They're a threat to us. They've been encouraged by the West. A whole series of propagandist allegations which don't actually bear any relationship to the behaviour of modern Kiev and modern Ukraine. This is a war based on a falsehood.
So how do we reorder the world? We've got Russia, along with the UK, permanent member of the Security Council. We've got a significant portion of United Nations members not supporting the Western position on Ukraine. Assuming that some kind of settlement can be reached in Ukraine, how should we reorder the world?
I'm afraid I'm challenging your assumption because I can't see at the moment what settlement can you be reached in the Ukraine that the Ukrainians can sign up to. We just heard the Ukrainian ambassador say that even any solution that would be negotiated had to be put to a referendum. So I think any solution that has been negotiated has to be very much in the interests of the Ukrainians themselves.
Right, well,
but if you could move a step further and say what...
Well, no. I mean, just go back on myself... If we assume this stays a limited conflict, that NATO doesn't intervene, what in the meantime can we do to sort of try and make the world work in future?
I think the taboo of accepting this new situation, the new status quo that the Russians are trying to create, we must not accept that. And I think that's very important. And curiously, again, I think that my Russian colleagues see that. I've talked a lot to some Russian colleagues of mine at universities, and they have said that they foresee a long period in which you have a renewed Cold War, in which you have some sort of negotiated peace in Ukraine, which the West will refuse to accept and which the rest will refuse to recognize because it would be a new status quo. And so they foresee this and they are actually afraid of it and they don't want it.
Am I right to say NATO's not going to get involved?
I don't know. Certainly, I think as things stand, NATO won't get involved. I think if we get anywhere near biological, chemical or nuclear weapons, I think the story changes absolutely fundamentally. And what one primary task clearly must be to deter. In that situation, I don't see how we can avoid actually offering and suggesting that there will be the use of muscle by NATO.
And if it came to just by sheer weight of force and attrition that Russia effectively occupied large parts of Ukraine.
Which I fear.
Would we still then not get engaged militarily?
I rather doubt it, sadly. I mean, I would like to see us, you know, being willing to challenge that, but I don't know that we will. I think we're much more likely then to go for a policy of containment, of isolation of Russia, one where you deepen the differences, you deepen the fault lines in Europe. And that will be quite a challenge to the Western allies to keep together in that situation.
And what about China, India, other world powers?
Actually crucial, because one of the things that is happening here is that we're trying to make an example of Russia. We're trying to show the other countries that they shouldn't try it on either. And it's actually interesting to see how relatively hesitant China has been. You know, they've been to some extent supportive. They've been sort of equivocating on a number of things that haven't come out fully in the condemnation of Russia. But it's been interesting to see that they would much rather pursue a course, continue to pursue a course that is nonviolent. I was actually to some extent reassured by that, you know, that they didn't simply seize this opportunity, for example, to go into Taiwan or anything like that.
But China is interested in not respecting 1945 borders, isn't it? You know, we've seen that.
With regard to Taiwan and the South China Sea and various other things. I mean, there are a lot of disputed areas, of course, around China with its neighbours. And yet it's amazingly enough not used force in a blatant way so far. And I think that's quite admirable.
Do you think perhaps it was waiting to see how it went?
I think there's an element of that. It hasn't recognised the acquisition of Ukraine, you know. I think their argument is that they have law on their side in relation to Taiwan. And so I think they will stick to this legalistic position. Remains to be seen how they'll behave. But I think they may well not entirely desert Russia, but the notion that somehow they will give it uncovenanted and extra support, I wonder. I think Russia may find that it's a relatively disappointing ally from that point of view. But it does pose a challenge, China, Russia, India. They pose a challenge in that we've got to have much more active diplomacy than we've had for years, putting forward our values, persuading people, arguing about the issues. You know, we have to go into a different gear.
But do we also need a bigger stick?
I think we haven't got bigger stick on
to develop.
We can try to.
Is still the dominant military power.
Yes, but on the other hand, we are actually in a different world from the point of view of using force. You know, we don't want to rattle our saber of nuclear weapons and things like that. We don't do that sort of thing any longer. We have a different attitude to war, I think, today.
But do we have to change it, maybe?
I think so. I do think so. I would hope we don't go back, you know, to with bayonets and sort of, you know, riding out to battle. But I do think we have to toughen up our stance, and we do have to recognise that actually the world as it stands at the moment is slipping away from us.
And I think one thing we have to learn to do is make economic sacrifices for this, because the very least we can do is make economic sacrifices. The sacrifice in treasure rather than sacrifice in life, I think that should be undisputed.
But also it could well be that economic sanctions, if we did manage to cut off Russia, for example, I mean, it would ultimately hurt them more than it would hurt us, wouldn't it?
Hopefully, but at the moment, I keep thinking it hurts the little people much more in our societies, and it hurts the rich. I think it's the poor people who now find that their electricity bills and their gas bills are very, very high and can't afford them. It's actually affecting a part of the demography that we didn't want to hurt.
I want to ask you about the practicalities of the war. Argument being made, for example, by Ben Wallace that, and we've heard it from Boris Johnson as well, that this war shows that, you know, the tank is no longer key to winning land battles. Do you agree with that?
Not at all, no. I think what's been interesting is that we have seen so much of tank warfare, and yet we haven't actually driven the Russians out, or the Ukrainians haven't driven the Russians out. They're still there. They're still waging fairly important campaigns in the east, and they are, despite the losses, it seems to be what the Germans used to call in the First World War a materiel battle. You know, it used to be a battle of attrition, and that's still going on. And it's extraordinary how much it resembles still World War II type campaigns.
You agree with that?
Well, I do. I mean, it's the way the Russians are conducting it. I mean, it does matter.
Because that does suggest that we are perhaps shifting towards the wrong military posture.
I have some real questions about, you know, whether we've got it right. I also question the assumption we don't need many people or, you know, fighters and people on the ground.
There's the Defence Secretary saying, I wouldn't necessarily increase the size of the infantry. I wouldn't necessarily buy more tanks. I would get more anti-drone capability.
Well, I think it's partly the advice he gets. It's also what the companies want to sell. I mean, it's lots and lots of pressure in the direction of more spec, more electronic stuff, more space. We do need space, undoubtedly, and less of the old conventional.
But perhaps we're not learning the right lessons at the moment at governmental levels.
Perhaps not.
What about Sweden and Finland joining NATO? Does that matter?
Yes, it does. I mean, I would like to see it happen. Whether they will, this is a really democratic decision to be taken, and it will be taken, I think, in both of those countries, extremely democratically.
Next, for a view from the United States, not long ago the world's unipolar power, I had a wide-ranging discussion on the consequences of war in Ukraine with Professor Francis Gavin, the Giovanni Agnelli Distinguished Professor and inaugural director of the Henry A. Kissinger Center for Global Affairs at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. We began with the dramatic, likely expansion of NATO to include Finland and Sweden.
I think it's extraordinary. I think if you had asked me on February 23rd, would Finland and Sweden be applying towards NATO, it would have seemed really far-fetched. And I think it is evidence of how quick-moving the situation in Europe and in the international system is. I think it's also evidence of what a grave miscalculation Putin made about the state of play in the international system. And I also think it is a sign of unexpected resilience, depth, and strength of the Western alliance and even U.S. leadership.
I mean, he, of course, sees it as a provocation.
Yes, but he has no one to blame but himself. And it's not clear, given how his power has been diminished by the incompetence of his military in Ukraine, that there's really much he can do about it. What he's left with in terms of options to respond are really quite limited in terms of economic or political pressure. And the sorts of military acts he might resort to are fairly escalatory. And at this point, I think hard to imagine being used. So I don't really see Russia or Putin with many options to prevent this from happening.
And what difference do you think it makes in practice? Because after all, Finland and Sweden, you know, they're members of the European Union. Boris Johnson has independently, on behalf of the UK, guaranteed their security. So, I mean, weren't they really part of NATO anyway? Or is this a really important kind of diplomatic statement if they, as seems likely, end up being members?
So that's a great point. I think one of the dirty little secrets of the Cold War is that even though both countries were neutral, when you talk to intelligence officials, certainly Sweden was secretly collaborated with the West. There's even some hints and evidence that Finland may have actually been in communication during the Cold War. And then after the Cold War, of course, I think there was a sense that Finland and Sweden were affiliated and associated with Western military efforts, if not formally associated with it. I think that the impact is severalfold. One, you're right, if there ever had been a war, one would have expected, depending on how it played out, Sweden and Finland to be associated with it. But unlike some recent NATO aspirants, these are some, you know, Finland, you know, I would not want to fight against the Finns, right? I mean, this is a country that, due to its neutrality and due to its experience fighting the Soviets during the Winter War, actually has serious military capabilities.
That's what I say. You wouldn't want to fight against the Ukrainians either.
Right. No, that's right. So I think this is actually additive. Oftentimes with NATO expansion, there's been a concern about a dilution of military effort. I think this is actually additive to capabilities. But I think the bigger element is both psychological and political, in that for a very long time, Putin's Russia was able to hold a lot of Europe, make them cautious for fear of Russian power, its ability, both in terms of its actual kinetic military force, but also its kind of asymmetric capabilities to confuse, to deter Europe from kind of coming together. And I think now that Russia has been exposed for its incompetence, that we all overestimated not just its kinetic military capabilities, but clearly its cyber capabilities, its economic wherewithal, that now you're seeing a sense that Russia is not to be as feared as it once was. There's, as I've said in the beginning and is always lurking behind, there's always that escalation to something we don't want to think about, which is the use of nuclear weapons. But short of that, I think the psychological impact that you combine Finland and Sweden with the changes in Germany, the sense throughout Europe that it has to do more, spend more to increase more on its the defense of Europe. I think it's part and package of a profound transformation of the European attitude towards Russia and towards its own security.
And do you think that the idea talked about in the early 1990s by both Clinton and Yeltsin of Russia becoming part of NATO, was that ever credible?
It's funny. I was recently looking at Strobe Talbot's memoirs, and if you read those, you know, Strobe was one of the architects of NATO expansion. He makes it clear that the way they put it, and President Clinton has recently said this as well, is that obviously in the short and medium term, it was not realistic, but that as an aspiration, as a goal, following the sort of Gorbachev idea of peace from the Atlantic to the Urals, it was not ruled out. And I think the way I would put it is this: there was a sincere desire not to make NATO an anti-Russian alliance, and that the moves that were made to expand NATO had to do with providing security and stability for Central and Eastern Europe, which I think was understood as something important and an interest of Russia's as well, and an idea of helping institutionalize democracy, markets, sort of Western affiliation of these states in the same way that the EU has. You know, I think while the question of whether Russian membership was on the table or not, I think the general view was there was a hope that Russia would transform itself in such a way, and there was a lot of hope for this in the 90s, that NATO membership wouldn't have seemed far-fetched because NATO was being seen less as a security entity and more as a kind of an affiliation of like-minded, liberal, open societies. And I think if Russia had developed in that way, it was certainly a possibility. Some of the policymakers said, absolutely not. We were always worried about Russia coming back. We wanted to make sure these old states from the Warsaw Pact were protected. So it's an interesting and open debate. But I do think Russia had it within its power to transform itself such that it would have been very hard for NATO to say, you know what, no, we can't let you in if you really want
to. And why
to
didn't it? Because you see, there's an argument that it was somehow spurned or pushed away by the West.
Yeah, no. So this is, I've often found, you know, when I was at the University of Texas, I started a center named after Bob Strauss. And Strauss had been the last American ambassador to the Soviet Union and the first to Russia. And you would talk to people like Strauss and people around him, and they were so optimistic and hopeful for Russia. There, you know, people forget this, but in the 90s and the 2000s, there were a whole variety of people, Democrats and Republicans in the United States, who really had great hopes for Russia, wanted to see it transform. A lot of people who encouraged private sector investment, partnerships, and that didn't happen. There were also people in the 90s and 2000s, and again, this doesn't divide along partisan lines. Some of my Democratic friends were like this, who sort of believed that Russia was hopeless, that you saw evidence, whether it was in Kosovo in the reaction, whether it was the wars in Chechnya, whether it was the corruption, that Russia, for whatever reason, was nowhere near able to transform itself to be part of clubs like NATO and part of the West. And this was a big debate.
I'm going to read you a sentence now from a paper you wrote, Future Proof for Engelsberg Ideas. A very interesting paper, I think. But here's the sentence. Building tanks and harvesting wheat seem like poor indicators of future power. An invasion and conquest seem like a loser's bet. Now, that, of course, was before the invasion of Ukraine. But is that kind of your end of history moment? Is that a sentence you would revise now?
No. In fact, I'm thinking of writing something, the exception that proves the rule. I've just completed Richard Overy's terrific book on World War II, Blood and Iron. And what's going on in Ukraine right now would be a footnote to a footnote to a footnote of what was being done in the 1940s in terms of war. And the argument I was making there was that the nature of the problems that are truly existential and the way we measure power and the way you get ahead in the world is actually not by seizing the Donbass. Let's say Russia had completely won What would they have for it? You know, would they be that much more powerful? Would they have the elements of intellectual power? Would they have the elements of innovation? Would they have the ability to, you know, affect outcomes outside of the Donbass? I mean, what's interesting to me is when Russia was at its most effective, it's when it was exploiting disinformation, when it was doing asymmetric stuff, using information technology, affecting elections, sowing discord.
This is the Trump era, really.
Yeah, and that's when Russia seemed truly powerful. I believe that the West absolutely has done the right thing and should do more to rally to support Ukraine. But I also think that this war has demonstrated that the limits of kinetic conventional military power, the difficulties of fully mobilizing a society to fight total war like you could 70 years ago, and the fact that even if you were to quote unquote win, the sort of coal and wheat and even natural gas and oil that tipped the balance during the 1940s and why you were willing to throw millions of soldiers into the battle, in the long run, aren't the kind of things that are going to determine who's a great power in the world. Now, this is actually something I think China knows. What matters is, do you have a Silicon Valley? Do you have a London City or New York where you can generate trillions in finance and generate all sorts of innovation that provide you with the power that actually allows you to shape outcomes?
But I mean, against that, we've got the prospect quite possibly of famine, because Russia and Ukraine provide a significant proportion of the world's wheat exports, particularly in Africa. And we've certainly got what's been called a cost of living crisis, but it's inflation and the danger of recession in Western Europe and North America, precisely because of the price of energy going up so dramatically. So it's not, if you like, a war aim of Putin, but it shows that those conventional things of taking territory and disruption through military can have very, very grave impacts, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think, one, this is the benefit of being a historian. I mean, compare the world today to, say, the 1970s, let alone the 1930s and 1940s. And I don't mean to minimize particularly the food crisis and the danger of famine, but our ability to actually respond to this. I mean, if you look at the 1970s, when major energy producers were taken off the market, the level of disruption, you look at, say, 73, 74, you know, in the United States, there were West Virginia highways were seized by armed truckers on strike. There was a sense that the United States could not rely on any of its European allies to resupply Israel during the war. The level of inflation was twice what it is today, in addition to having a recession. So, you know, things are obviously bad, but I think what sometimes people forget is that in the 50 years since then, the international economy has developed such that there's a greater resilience and adaptability. That doesn't mean it's infinite, but you know, you look, we went through 2 years of a pandemic where during certain times, the global economy appeared to be shut down, yet there wasn't famine then. I think that would have been inconceivable if there were, such a thing had happened even 20 or 30 years ago. And I only point this out to say, my argument is not that war is going to go away. And my argument is not to say that this does not come at some cost. It's to say that it highlights the miscalculation of someone like Putin, that he's thinking in terms of the 1930s and 40s, that somehow he will add to his power by adding the Donbass, when instead, I think this is where it's different in Beijing, they understand that if they want to sort of compete with the United States and the West, they actually have to attract intellectual talent, capital, they have to innovate. I still stand by that sentence. I will say that there are many people who disagreed when I wrote it, and they really disagree with it now, but I very much think the Ukraine is the exception that proves the rule. Anyone who now, I mean, if you're in Beijing right now, you've got to be thinking long and hard about whether or not you want to sort of do that cross-strait invasion of Taiwan and think it's going to work out well.
problem, though, is that Russia is still a nuclear power, isn't it? And, well, certainly tactically at the moment, but I suppose ultimately there could be a sort of mad threat strategically. That is perhaps its last remaining lever of power.
Yes, and this is one that needs to be taken seriously. My point earlier, too, about the war being less of a useful instrument to accomplish political aims, there's any number of reasons that's true, but one of them is because of the power of nuclear deterrence. There are limits to what you can do. The West and NATO has been deterred from intervening in this conflict because of nuclear weapons, but I think to a certain extent, Putin has been deterred from doing things that he might otherwise have done in a non-nuclear world, such as, I'm sure, bombing supply depots in Poland, if not concerned for the response of NATO and the potential escalation, which risks nuclear war. So nuclear weapons are a shadow over all of this. And what makes it so dangerous is that you're trying to guess what your adversary's limits are. And I do think we have to be mindful of that. I do think we probably haven't given enough thought to what an ending in Ukraine looks like, such that Ukraine wins, Russia loses, but it isn't pushed into such a corner that it feels the need to escalate to the use of nuclear weapons. That's an unknowable question, but it's one that deserves a lot of thought.
And I mean, just on that, does that mean that, you know, kind of whatever the outcome in Ukraine, and as you say, it doesn't look like it's going to be total victory in any sense for Russia, that after that, within the world order, we just revert to the status quo of the United Nations and the Security Council and a basically dollar-based economy?
So I think there is probably no going back to status quo ante with Russia for a variety of reasons. I think we can't say it. It can't be a stated goal. But Putin's Russia has demonstrated, even before this, very little interest in being a contributing member to a well-functioning global order. Even China, for all of its issues and problems and concerns and challenges, at least recognizes the importance of things like sovereignty, the importance of the United Nations, the importance of some of the international financial institutions. It certainly violates lots of rules. It does lots of things that cut against that. But Russia, for any number of reasons, has very rarely shown its interest or affiliation in that. And so it's hard to see that changing afterwards. And it's a dilemma. This is a giant landmass that covers 11 time zones. But it's also one going through a demographic implosion. You know, by 2100, Chad will have more people than Russia. So it's a puzzle as to what you do with Russia after this. It's hard to imagine a circumstance where you just simply let Putin's Russia back in. On the other hand, one does have to come up with some thought or plan of how you reintegrate such a large country with nuclear weapons back into the international system. And I don't have an answer for that. To me, what the really, really interesting and actually long-term, more consequential question is, does this offer an opportunity to rethink or reset relations with China? Because while this war is deeply upsetting, a war between China and, say, the United States would be orders of magnitude worse. China is a country with almost 20% of the world's population, incredibly innovative, dynamic economy. It's not one that you could simply ignore. And so I think the real interesting action in the international system will be what China takes away from this and how Western Chinese relations develop.
Well, that China might be chastened by Putin's problems.
So that's the hope. Although I was thinking recently, I was having a conversation with someone about President Kennedy's peace speech and at American University in June 1963, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Russians backed down to an American ultimatum and obviously lost, and the Americans and the West were furious. And there was a temptation after that, in October 1962, to seek to further humiliate and bring down the Russians. And Kennedy made another decision. He realized that this would actually be the ideal time to try to seek an accommodation. And then you get, with the help of Macmillan and the British, partial test ban treaty in the summer of 63 and a general decrease in the sort of threats and dangers of the Cold War. The Cold War doesn't go away, but it becomes much less dangerous. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately because I've been thinking, you know, I wonder if there isn't some opportunity to say to China, look, we don't agree with a lot of what you do, but you're not Russia. You know, we're not Russia. We've seen over the last 2 years with 15 million dead as a result of COVID, what the cost of us not having a relationship is. And we've seen in Ukraine what a war could look like. We don't have to agree. We're always going to be call out your human rights violations, your trade violations. You're not going to like some of the things we do. But the current situation is unraveling towards what would be a true catastrophe. Is there some way we can find a way to an accommodation that avoids that? I don't know if that's true. That's certainly not the mood in Washington, but that's certainly something that I think people should be thinking about.
Yeah, and you talk about the new transnational threats, things like global public health, obviously brought very much to mind by COVID, climate change, inequality, migration, potentially a big threat in Europe and the United Kingdom, as well as, of course, to America's southern borders and disruptive technologies. And do you envisage the possibility of a world order, including the United States and China and Europe, which is actually cooperative on those issues?
I don't think we have all fully registered the extent to which the abject failure of the two leading states in the system, China and the United States, during this pandemic. It's not like global public health wasn't something that either of the two countries hadn't thought about. They'd gone through SARS in the early 2000s and cooperated. And the sort of complete failure of coordination, cooperation, and leadership on the part of both countries is astounding. And I think in a counterfactual world where China and the United States had at least had some level of cooperation where they said, you know what, we disagree deeply, but we're not going to politicize this. One could certainly imagine outcomes that were still bad, but not as catastrophic as they have been. And I think, honestly, I tend to be an optimist, but one thing that has been depressing is that that set of circumstances hasn't really generated a shift in attitude, neither capital to say, wow, we ran that experiment and that was really bad. And why don't we try to do better for the next one or whatever the next thing is that we're not anticipating, some kind of climate related crisis. I don't think there's any argument one can make to be hopeful or optimistic about it. But, you know, perhaps given the dangers that have occurred with this war, that would be an opportunity to say, look, this is just another example of the reasons why we don't have to agree. We don't have to be friends. We are going to be ideological and geopolitical rivals, but there are real material and human costs to our lack of having any kind of positive relationship.
You say you're an optimist, and in a sense, your worldview is the one that's probably been common in Western democracies since the Second World War. How confident can we be that America is back and back on board on that?
Again, throughout the Trump years, I often relied on my historical sensibility. One can spend some time, say, during the presidency of Andrew Jackson or the true crisis in the United States in the 1850s over slavery that led to a civil war, to the sense of chaos in the 1890s, to say, you know, the U.S. has often had these periods of division, anger, violence. And, you know, that argument can get you so far. Again, another thing that I think has surprised me is the extent to which, especially after the January 6th insurrection, that those elements of the Republican Party, including Donald Trump, that have not disassociated themselves with those events and have not disassociated themselves from the lie about the saying the election was rigged or stolen, still have political standing. I mean, it's worrisome. You know, my optimism My optimism has taken some hits. I've always have concerns about World War III breaking out. But, you know, the dangers that we've seen, you know, disinformation, climate, public health, weakness of democracy, we actually know how to beat the Russian military. In a non-nuclear world, you know, our power, if the Ukrainians can clean the clocks of the Russians, I mean, I'm actually not so worried about the conventional military capabilities of, say, the U.S. and Great Britain and other friends to defeat any and all comers, including China, by the way. But what I worry about is that that's not where the real dangers that threaten us are, and that we don't have. The U.S. is very good at fighting wars. It's really terrible at organizing against public health or dealing with threats of disinformation or some of the things that we're or certainly, you know, dealing with climate change. And that's why I wrote the piece. And that's why I'm very heartened by what's happening in Ukraine. And it actually makes me more convinced than ever that what I said I was right about.
So terrible as it is, it could have beneficial consequences for the world order.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I have to think about why this is, but the COVID crisis did not generate any real momentum to talk about world order or have discussions with China. Whereas this war, I think, has generated far more movement. I mean, you just look at what's happened in Europe, what you started the podcast with, talking about Finland and Sweden. You think there's a political change that happened overnight that's inconceivable. And there is something about war that does generate. And you know, part of this is muscle memory. Part of our institutions, you know, 19th and 20th century institutions were created and generated and honed on traditional war. And they know how to think about and deal with war. They don't have the muscle memory or the capability to deal with some of these other things, which I think is a greater challenge. But if you can use war to at least get people to think about whether the world order can be repaired, that would be a start.
Professor Gavin there, speaking from his porch in Washington, D.C., the bird song in his backyard underpinning his optimism, even in these dark times. Thanks for listening to this Worldview podcast, the first in a series of reflections on war for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer is Mary Jessel, assisted by Eve Webster. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Please join us again soon.